The big story, of course, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife captured, brought to the U.S. They're going to appear in federal court later on today at noon in the U.S. District Court, Southern District of New York. And there are a lot of questions here. The legality constitutionally, what the international world thinks, why we did this, what now moving forward for this country, but also what the people of Venezuela think about this. A UN fact-finding mission found that there were a lot of human rights violations and crimes against humanity inside Venezuela with Maduro as the head. Alejandro Velasco is the Associate Dean for Faculty and Associate Professor, Department of History at NYU, a real expert here in Venezuelan studies. Perfect person to talk to. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Let's talk about everyone agrees he was a bad guy. And so what are the reactions of people inside Venezuela today?
Well, they're a little bit mixed. Certainly, as you say, there was very little love lost for Maduro. He, lost resoundingly in the presidential election held last July that he did not recognize and, of course, remained in power. But before then, for the 10 prior years that he was president, had increasingly mounted significant state repression against opposition movements and also within movements in his own party, the Socialist Party. And so there was not a lot of love lost for Maduro himself. But then, of course, that's tempered by the fact that most, in fact, all of his inner circle remains in place. So there's really been no change other than, of course, that Maduro is no longer at the head of the state, but the rest of the state remains in power. And so that's, any kind of joy is tempered by the reality of what seems like status quo.
Dean, President Trump says the U.S. is going to run Venezuela temporarily. And historically speaking, how do foreign-led transitions kind of tend to be received over time? And even when people initially feel relieved.
I mean, the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America is long and pretty sordid and has a very poor track record. On the other hand, what we're seeing in this moment is something that is somewhat unprecedented. I mean, what we're seeing, as I mentioned before, is that the titular head of state is gone, but the rest of the state remains exactly in place. And it's consolidated actually quite quickly. I think what that might suggest is that the remaining power players in Venezuela probably struck some sort of deal with the Trump administration beforehand to say, if you let us stay in power, we can deliver stability. And that's a kind of version of regime change that we've not seen in Latin America to date. So there's lots of questions as to whether this will follow a script or whether it will break from a storied script.
Well, and another question that I have is there going to be a struggle for power? Is it going to lead to opposition parties rising up? Is there going to be unrest?
Election.
Yeah. I mean, where does that stand as, potentially you have other factions fighting for power there?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest challenge facing this interim government in Venezuela right now is that they have to do two extremely contradictory things at the same time. The first is they have to, in some ways, try to hold true, at least in discourse, to what has been the hallmark of the Chavista movement over the last 25 years, which is anti-U.S., anti-imperialism, sovereignty, nationalism, etc. But on the other hand, it seems like they're going to have to do exactly Trump's bidding, especially as it relates to the oil industry, which has been the primary source of revenue to keep that inner circle in line through the distribution of dwindling oil rents to especially the military, which runs vast sectors of the economy. And so you're right. I think part of the question will be as oil revenues go to the United States rather than to the military and the inner circle, is there going to be an increasing power faction? I think right now they're probably betting that as long as we can remain in power and out of jail, we're willing to sacrifice some access to oil resources. But if that doesn't pan out, absolutely, we could see some really significant struggles within the ruling coalition.
Marco Rubio talked about this yesterday, about the influence there in Venezuela, that China and Russia, had a lot of influence with Maduro in power. Do you think that changes with whatever comes forward and moves forward in this country?
It certainly will change the primary interest of Russia and China and Venezuela, as with most countries, is oil. Right now, the primary receiver of Venezuelan oil is China. And China has invested billions upon billions of dollars in Venezuela's economy over the last 10 to 15 years. And so part of the question will be if indeed now there's going to be this redirected flow of oil, not to China, but to the United States, will China say, wait a minute, that's not something that we're willing to tolerate? And then that's going to raise geopolitical another sphere. On the other hand, China may be seeing a different opportunity here, right? The precedent that it's been set by having, foreign nation essentially kidnapped another head of state might be something that China looks kindly upon in its own sphere of influence. It says, well, if the United States can do it, we can as well. And so they may be willing to sacrifice Venezuela if it means that they can consolidate their own sphere of influence.
And so, Dean, for Venezuelans who are inside the country who may be afraid to leave their homes right now, they don't know what to look for, and should they be looking for food or staying put, what does history suggest happens in the immediate days after an event that is this unprecedented?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for my family and relatives who are there, it is this combination of tremendous anxiety about the future, but at the same time, trying to make sure that daily life continues as best as possible. That's been the kind of MO for Venezuelans for a long time under many different types of crises. And so, for instance, yesterday you saw, stores filled up, gas lines, pretty large, just people trying to stock up ahead of what they see as a very uncertain moment. But, what history has shown about these moments is that the best way to prepare is just to prepare for the unknown. Mm-hmm. And that's what Venezuelans are doing.
Alejandro Velasco, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate the discussion.
I thank you so much.
And, despite having these large deposits of oil there, almost 82% of Venezuelans live in poverty. So the money was not going to the Venezuelans.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And then, when you think of what the United States did by extracting Maduro, as he said, does the does Russia, one day say, maybe I'll just go get
that's the worry.
Ukraine, Ukraine's president, because I don't like him. I don't think he's a real president anyway. Or does China say, go to Taiwan and say, let me snatch, the Taiwan head of state over there? I mean, does that start something?
I don't know if it starts that necessarily. I do think that, again, when you're dealing with, a country that is so rich in energy, when they're so rich in oil, you're going to have, it's flies on food, right? You're going to get people flocking to this. And we've seen that traditionally, historically, and even more so recently with the China coming in, playing a bigger role, Russia coming in, playing a bigger role, obviously their ties to Iran and then Iran's ties to Venezuela. So that is a problem. That's the national security threat for the United States. If you want to weigh in on this, 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR, what does this set up going forward? I think that is a legitimate question.
Yeah, and what happens within that country in the short term with people trying to go to the grocery store?
Right.
And who really is running it? Because the president says we're going to run it, but Rubio on the Sunday show is like, no, we're not. We're going to have influence.
It is unbelievable, though, when you look at the reaction from some of the people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here in the United States, particularly in like places like Doral, Florida, that was big focus where there's a heavy concentration of Venezuelans.
Yep.
They were celebrating this. I mean, there are people in Venezuela that are, it's a mixed bag, obviously, but there are people that are like, thank God this guy's gone,
which is like 8 million people migrated since he's been in power.
Right.
Too.
Yeah. Right. So. 6:44 time for Eye on Engineering, brought to you by CSP, rethinking composites for a lighter, sustainable future.
While most safety developments seem to come in the passenger vehicle space, the trucking industry is constantly adding safety features to not only keep drivers and others safe, but also to help reduce the cost of accidents and lawsuits. One recent example is Peterbilt's addition of an electronic parking brake system on its Class 8 and medium-duty trucks. The optional IntelliPark EPB system is made by brake giant Bendix and has three key components. Rollaway prevention applies brakes on the vehicle and trailer if a driver exits without setting the parking brake. Auto trailer brake disengagement releases those brakes when movement is detected. And using sensors that monitor door position, seatbelt status, and vehicle movement, Smart Unpark confirms a rig is ready to be parked or unparked. Peterbilt also said the system is quieter and easier to maintain than manual systems. For SAE International, I'm Chris Klontz, and that's an Eye on Engineering.